Your Steve Jones Show podcast will start shortly. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Brewers Outlet, your beverage supermarket on Reagan Street in Sunbury. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome. Great to have you with us on this Friday, brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. Imports, domestics, microbrews, best selection of beer anywhere. Wine coolers, water, soft drink, snacks. They roast their peanuts fresh and hot every day in the pickle bar, led by the barrels and the dills. Indeed, second to none. Champ Week's coming up. Stock up at Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. And we are in the Sunbury Motors studio. Sunbury Motors, the best in the business. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. A lot coming up today, including Dwight Gault, the strength and conditioning coach at Penn State, and how the winter workout program has gone. It's going to be some great information in there. We'll hear from Kim Jones, NFL Network, Neil Coulong, USA Today. First, we're going to revisit an interview we had with Ed Sherman, who wrote a book about the Big Ten and was kind enough to join us just a few weeks ago. And in fact, I'm going to Chicago tonight for Penn State Northwestern tomorrow at 4 on, beginning at 3:30. And it's great to have Ed Sherman with us and some of the reasons why he decided to write a book like this on the Big Ten.
You know, everyone's kind of asked me that, and I really didn't think it was that daunting because I had an approach. Obviously, there's a ton of history, and we go back all the way to 1895. And I think my approach was, and maybe this is what helped me, is that I kind of wanted to write what the Big Ten was all about and what made the Big Ten the Big Ten. And it really goes back a lot to the addition of Penn State. And when that happened in 1990, Jim Delaney was the new commissioner, and he had just started. Pretty much, he was in his first year. Didn't have that culture already, you know, ingrained in him about what the Big Ten was all about. And he threw it out there. Okay, what are we going to, you know, 10, 11 schools, not the Big Ten anymore. What are we going to name the conference? And the reply was that we're not changing the name. It's still the Big Ten. Even from Penn State, people said we joined the Big Ten. We didn't join another conference. And so I think that kind of, and he kind of realized that it wasn't a number, the Big Ten wasn't a number, it was a brand. It was something that represented, you know, a lot of things to a lot of people. And you know, foremost is that it's been the premier conference in college sports since the beginning. It was the first conference. And by many measurements, it still is the premier conference. And so I kind of used that as a starting point and kind of went from there to kind of tell the story. What's unique about the Big Ten as far as athletes and coaches and famous happenings, and so many firsts, you know, came from the Big Ten, including being the first conference, being the first conference that did a tie-in with a bowl game with the Rose Bowl, the first conference that really started this whole realignment thing, you know, where the map has dramatically changed with the addition of Penn State. You think about what seismic shift that was like. And then also the first conference to have their own network, and people said they were crazy. And, you know, obviously the Big Ten's getting the last laugh on that one. So that's where I started and then kind of went from there.
Yeah, believe me, I was there in 89 and 90 when Penn State joined, so I remember it was not actually the easiest route either for them to go, because I believe, if I recall correctly, the vote was 7-3.
7-3, right.
Yeah,
Steve, I'll give you a little history. We broke the story at the Chicago Tribune.
Right.
And it came so far out of left field. I mean, it was three counties out of left field.
Yeah.
My teammate Skip Mislinski came up to me and said, "You're not going to believe this." One of the athletic directors, I'm not going to say who, said that, "Can you believe that they're going to add Penn State to the Big Ten?" And I said, "What are you talking about? They're adding Penn State. They're adding Penn State's joining the Big Ten." And I'm like, "Okay, we got to check this out." So we made some phone calls. Sure enough, we got it confirmed, and it was the led the whole newspaper. It was a big story, obviously, for not just you guys, for all of conference sport, college sports, concerning the magnitude of Penn State. And that was an amazing time. I was there for that first game. I write a section in the book, probably about a 6 or 7 page section, about the whole backstory and Penn State joining the conference, how that came about, and the ramifications of that. And that was a huge, huge, when you look at the last 30 years of the Big Ten, I mean, that was a huge turning point. Really changed the conference significantly. I think it was a great addition. Led to Nebraska. You can argue about Maryland and Rutgers. I think Maryland obviously has a great basketball team. But it really changed the face of the Big Ten. That was huge.
If I recall the story correctly, at least from my point of view with the people I've talked to over the years, they essentially had to convince Northwestern they weren't going to be kicked out. So they would vote yes.
You know, I haven't heard that version of the story. You know, and that's, you know, so that, and that, you know, there's obviously a lot of different stories. I knew it was hardly a slam dunk. They admit, and he talks in the book, that they could have handled it better. They kind of did this without, you know, basically said without really incorporating the athletic directors. And there was a huge outcry from the athletic directors. Bo Schembechler, who was the athletic director at Michigan, was vehemently against it. But they got it done. I think Stanley Eikenberry, formerly of Penn State, University of Illinois presence, really wanted it. And he's, you know, I talked to him for this in the book. He's actually writes another piece in the book. You know, obviously it was very controversial at the time, but it was a huge addition to the Big Ten. And obviously it was the right move and the best move at the time. And it's just a seismic move. And here's another thing to consider. What's it been now, 29 years now since they joined?
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, there's a whole generation of people who don't know anything else but Penn State being in the Big Ten. I mean, it's 29 years. And it's an incredible amount of period of time and a lot of great history that they've been able to accomplish in the Big Ten.
Back in the early days, obviously Red Grange in the 20s has to be a part of this. Jesse Owens has to be a part of this. When you write about the history of the Big Ten, what do these figures not only mean to the Big Ten being the brand it is today, but what did they mean to the advancement of sports in this country to make it the obsession it is today?
So here's probably, I think, my favorite stat in of everything that I saw. If you remember, at the end of the 20th century, ESPN did this Sports Century series where they voted the top 50 athletes of the 20th century. Five of the top 33, not even five of the top 50, five of the top 33 had Big Ten connections. And let me go through this list for you. Jesse Owens, I think, was sixth. Jack Nicklaus was ninth. Magic Johnson was, I think, 17th. Red Grange was in the 20s. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact figure. And Mark Spitz was 33. So five athletes, and you talk about, these are athletes who have endured for generations. I just went down to Champaign. They just did a symposium with the students. They had 400 kids from the sports business program. We did a symposium on Red Grange. It's almost been 100 years since Red Grange last carried a football in Champaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, and that legacy carries on. And obviously, Red Grange was the first superstar football player in college sports, and he became, in the 20s, he was as big as Babe Ruth and Jack Dempsey and Bobby Jones in golf. I mean, he was an icon back then. Jesse Owens, I mean, I don't think we need to, you know, everyone knows the story of Jesse Owens, although they don't know the Big Ten story of Jesse Owens.
Right.
You know, they talk about what he did at Berlin was great, but he, in the 1935 Big Ten track meet,
yes,
he set four world records, not just four world records in one day, four world records in 45 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing. You know, I write about that, and his daughter did a contribution in the book. Another one of my great favorite stats, Jack Nicklaus at Ohio State, he won the Big Ten tournament, I want to say 1961. He won it by 23 shots. I mean, I can't even wrap my arms around 23 shots. You know, maybe, I mean, I feel like I was in the field, you know, and I think, you know, can you imagine 23 shots? And the great thing was that they qualified, they won the title by one shot. So they needed
all the shots.
Isn't that amazing? And so I write about, you know, I write about the icons. I have a section about the icons. I have a section about with long, you know, I tried to do storytelling. I didn't want it to be like a Wikipedia type thing. So there's 300 photos in the book, but there's also 80,000 words of type. If people get the book, be warned, it's a heavy book. It's 352 pages, and it weighs about 5 pounds. I think it's a great-looking book. We got a lot of great photos that kind of also we wanted to try to tell the vibe of the Big Ten through some photos, and so we kind of use these photos to kind of break up the sections and talk, you know, to just really show what the fans like, the experience, what it's like to be a champion, to celebrate. We had some great – I have one of my favorite pictures is a two-page women's Penn State women's volleyball winning one of their titles. One of the women in the center is jumping up, you know, like about as high as the net, you know, and the expression on her face is amazing. So we didn't get everything in the book, you know, it wasn't all the news that fits to print, but I think we tried to get the feel of what this conference has been like, and you know, and I hopefully, you know, people, there's something, I tried to make something for everyone. There's a Penn State, four-page Penn State section in the book. We do a story on the great success of the Penn State wrestling program in the 2010s. So, that, again, we tried to get, as I say, there's something on every on your school and on every school. So hopefully people I'm really excited for people to see this book and to kind of see the tradition of the conference and see where their school kind of contributed and fit in the conference.
This conference is in the financial shape it is today, in part because of what Jim Delaney has done. If you're a commissioner, people are going to be able to take shots at you and anything you do.
Right,
I don't
sure.
care if you're Adam Silver or Jim Delaney. But there's a realism to it. You're not getting $54, $55 million a year unless this guy's negotiated his brains out to get there. And he almost got Notre Dame to come in, too, in 1999. What did it mean to you that he ended up writing the foreword to the book?
Well, I mean, the Big Ten published the books, you know, initially wasn't going to be the case.
And they
were engaged from the beginning. Initially, it was going to be someone, you know, meet myself or someone else publishing. And then I think the more they got into it, the more they decided that they wanted to be the publisher, since it was going to be a book on the history of the Big Ten. I first approached them on this in 2017. I went to Jim and went to a couple of his associates, high-ranking associates, and I said, this is what I want to do. There really hasn't been a book written about the Big Ten in almost 30 years. Obviously, it covers his tenure. And they were all in from the beginning. Not only were they all in, but I was overwhelmed by the amount of support I got from them and the interest and how enthusiastic they were about the project. I just recently had a book party at the Big Ten, basically to thank all these people. You know, we have to drink a toast to this book and to thank all these people who really were so vested in this project and really wanted to do well. So Jim was all in. I've known Jim. I was there from day one with Jim, 1989. Yep. And we still have a relationship, and we still get to play golf every a couple times a year, once or twice a year, and he's a fun guy to play golf, very competitive. And, you know, one of my favorite pictures in the book is that there's a cover, a 1969 Sporting News cover of Rick Mount. Well, Rick Mount's on the cover, but the guy guarding him is Jim Delaney,
Jim Delaney, North Carolina.
Yep. Is that amazing?
I know.
And I said, we got to run this cover in the book. And then we do a section on Rick Mount and a story on Rick Mount, who was a great player and, you know, obviously probably the best shooter in Big Ten history. Oh. And we ran the cover, you know, and it's just the coincidence of that is stunning.
One last question, because I know you have to go. One of the famous moments that opened the door for everybody to get to bowl games in the Big Ten was the 1973 Ohio State-Michigan
right.
game, obviously. Before then, only the Big Ten champion went to a bowl game.
How'd and not even handle- that. And even if there was a repeat, they wouldn't let the repeat team go. So someone else had to go.
Right. Somebody else had to go.
Kids to be out of school 2 years in a row.
Yeah, couldn't go back to back. How was it to tell that part of the story? Because they're still, obviously, the players are all still alive, but the coaches aren't.
Yeah, I think the fun part of that, and again, to show you how the Big Ten was invested in this book, I do a section in the Ohio State-Michigan rivalry and how I think that defines the conference, because it's the biggest rivalry, and it from that 10-year series, and it's really been the conference of Woody and Bo ever since. Even though these guys went, Woody and Bo wouldn't recognize the game now with the scores that are the last two couple, Michigan and Ohio State, they would be.
No.
They're definitely rolling. I did a tweet on. They're definitely rolling over in the grave. But it's still. I mean, you watch that game, and when you talk about the Big Ten, that's the conference of Woody and Bo, and so that 1973 game, for people who don't know, that it finished in a 10-10 tie, so they were tied, I think, 9-0-1, both of them. And so how are you going to – who's going to the Rose Bowl? That time, only one team went to a bowl game, and they did a vote of the athletic directors, and Ohio State won 6-4. And Bo was just beside himself, considering Ohio State had gone the year before, and he felt like they were being punished because late in the game their starting quarterback Dennis Franklin broke his collarbone, and I think he felt like that cost them, because maybe the athletic directors felt without Franklin that they would not fare well against USC at the time. And so the Big Ten, I said, I want to write about this, and Mark Rudner, who's the associate commissioner, says, "Oh, we still have the letters that we received, the angry letters." And he gets me a file, huge file, a foot deep of all these letters. So I kind of go through these letters, and we reprint some of the letters in the book in that section. So that was kind of a way of telling that story through people being angry, and I mean, people were comparing this to Watergate. I mean, back in the 70s, how this was kind of an atrocity at the level of Watergate and stuff. And Michigan fans were upset, and probably rightfully so.
I know we have to let you go. This book is, I think it's a must, especially during the holiday season. I'm thrilled that you're the one that got a chance to do it, because I know that you'd tell the story right. So, Ed, thanks so much. Really appreciate your time, and
anytime,
best of luck with
please
us.
Please give me a call if you guys wanted to talk about anything else, college sports. I'm always there. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ed Sherman, one of the best in the business. Great to have him with us. Neil Kulong, next half hour, brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. And we're in the Sunbury Motors studio, Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Party time, game time, or just fun time. Doesn't matter what time it is, because it's Brewers Outlet time. The beverage supermarket has the area's largest beer selection. Imports, microbrews, ciders, and domestics. Pick from over 100 ice-cold 12-packs and dozens of 24-ounce singles. Soda, snacks, hot sauces, fresh roasted peanuts. Make it one-stop party shopping, and don't forget the pickle bar. So whatever you're celebrating or just doing it up, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury, wants to see you. And thank you for your years of patronage.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you, the other guy's way or the SMC way. The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back. Today's show brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket, imports domestic microbrews, best selection of beer anywhere, wine coolers, water, soft drinks, snacks. They roast their peanuts fresh and hot every day. And the pickle bar led by the barrels and the dills, indeed, second to none. Get ready for championship week. Champ week. Stock up at Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. And we're in the Sunbury Motors studio, Sunbury Motors 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. All right, let's check in now with Neil Coulong, who went in search of his cell phone, finally got one.
It probably helps to have a phone that's less than 3 years old, which is what mine is now. Amazingly, I haven't cracked it or broken it, and it still kind of works. The battery is just kind of dead, and if it gets full, it kind of goes haywire. I think that's what happened.
Well, actually, we went out and we bought phones. We're going to get, you know, we talk about, okay, for our birthdays, let's get phones. Okay, great. All right. Now, our phones were 12 years old. So naturally, my hope was at the end of basketball season, when I have more time, we'll get phones. Well, my old phone and I did not have that agreement. And the sucker died like three weeks ago, so we had to go out and get new phones. So now I've got, I mean, I am now iPhone 11, amazingly, after being, I think, iPhone 2.
Mine was a relic. I'm not even sure that the label on mine wore off. I can't even tell which one it is on the outside. I got to dig in and find it, but I don't even know. I mean, I'm not sure. I just need a new one.
I mean, they wanted mine as a museum piece for the Apple Museum. I'm like, really? Great. Fabulous. We didn't know these were still in existence. Now, the problem is rebuilding your phone base, because mine, when I mean it died, it died. So I've been asking people left and right for their phone numbers. It's really... Yeah. Okay. Let's start with one of the favorite topics for people. What does one do with Bud Dupree?
It's interesting. A lot of what's coming out now, and you're hearing reports that the Steelers plan to tag him. If they also plan on picking up Vance McDonald's option, which is also something that's going out there right now, I don't understand how they think they're going to be able to get this all under the cap. And I'm also somebody that believes legitimately 95% of the salary cap just simply doesn't exist. It's a myth. It's
right.
More of a guideline.
It's what we would refer to as the Maginot line.
Yes. Yes. That's a very good analogy. You have to do a lot to really get competitively close to the cap. And when your goal is to roughly spend to the cap minus maybe 3%, which the Steelers have been over the last decade, being close to it isn't that big of a deal. They spent their money in free agency last year. I think the Minka Fitzpatrick thing came along and took away some of that, you know, residual money that would have been there this year. But all of those moves together do not suggest they're able to have the space to tag Dupree. So I don't know if that's possible or not. I think to some degree, I think they thought there was a decent chance of a new CBA being in play and certain, you know, moves that would have made it, they would have been able to restructure contracts the way that they usually do to free up some space to be able to make a move with Dupree. It doesn't look like that CBA is going to get signed in time. If they do tag him, I think it's probably because they feel like something will get done and then they'll be able to, but they're not going to be able to carry that kind of a cap charge. And we're talking about probably $15 million, $16 million, somewhere in there. Right. They're not going to have that space available without being able to do anything to their roster right now, which they really aren't if they're going to pick up McDonald's contract. That's without question the biggest amount of money, and that's $7 million. So you're talking total available for them is going to be $9, $10 million. Unless they're going to use the transition tag on him, which to a point to me, it almost seems unethical to do that. Yeah. I wouldn't really think that's a very good business move on their part. I think you have a guy that I think any agent is going to be able to negotiate something in the ballpark of 5 years, $70, $72 million with probably 30-ish million guaranteed, just based on what we've seen from the pass rushing market over the last 2 years. He's going to get that kind of a contract in free agency. To hold him off for a one-year deal of around $10 million, that's just not right. I don't think that the Steelers operate that way. I don't think they're intending to do that. So they know a lot more of what's going on internally than I do. So if they really do intend on giving him a franchise tag, which really isn't all that much better than the transition tag, something else has to be coming that we don't know about yet. Outside of the CBA, though, I'm not sure what that's going to be.
Neil, we're talking about big numbers here, obviously. And I know I would like to have my big numbers reserved for more complete players. But that's not the way the NFL is right now. I mean, you're not going to tell me that Bud Dupree is a complete player, and you're absolutely not going to tell me Vance McDonald's a complete player.
I would definitely agree with the latter. I think that Dupree, the way that he was used oftentimes last year, especially against more mobile quarterbacks, guys that want to get out of the pocket, I think you saw him spying a lot, which doesn't really boost his numbers much. He might not be able to be the all-out pass-rushing option that T.J. Watt is. I also don't think anybody would argue at this point in time Watt would get substantially more money on the open markets than Dupree would. But there's a lot of value to what he's doing as a run supporter at times in coverage as well. I think he's rounded out his game well from where he has been. But some would argue that, well, okay, great, he just did it 1 year in his contract year. What's the rest of his career going to be like?
Right.
Statistically speaking, you can't say he's going to continue to improve at that level. So where is he in year three in that deal? I think those are fair questions to have, and maybe that's something that would kind of front-load a contract and make it a little bit more manageable in the very short term, just 1 or 2 years, as opposed to 3 or 4, which a thoroughbred like Watt is going to get. All those things would play into it. I do think, though, there are teams with more cap space than the gross domestic product of some third-world countries, and they have more than enough money to grossly overpay just to get them on their team, because along with this CBA, you're going to see them introduce a much stricter salary floor. You're not going to be able to pull in. You're not going to be able to be at half of the salary cap entering a season the way that you are right now. You know, there are still 10 teams with $70 million in space. They can take on a Bud Dupree contract. In fact, I'd argue from a labor perspective, they need to pay somebody, and really a large part of that is they don't have a quarterback who's, coming up to contract right now. So they don't have that huge chunk. They've got to kind of make up that ground a little bit. Storing space year in and year out is not a solution. It's not getting any team any better. As we've seen from Indianapolis, now we're seeing it in Jacksonville. These are teams that have had success recently, added more cap space, and let the talent that they've had walk or, in some cases, randomly retire in August. You can't get by not paying players. Having some cap space is good for the sense of flexibility, but it's not proving to be a major difference between champions and non-champions. Having quarterbacks on good deals certainly is going to help, but I'd argue that all that means is that you have a good quarterback. You can make that argument up and down. Somebody would pay Bud Dupree if he was out there. Right now, I don't think the Steelers are really able to do that, and it's not often that I say a team truly can't make a move because of cap constraints, but that's the situation they're in. And I would argue it's less about the cap and more about the current status of the CBA. If there's a new CBA in place, they're able to restructure contracts and put years into the future beyond the CBA for a lot of their key guys. Hayward, for example, they can't do that where they sit right now. So without that, they don't really have the space available to make moves in this year. They definitely can in the future. A lot of it would depend on when they have that cap situation resolved, and it doesn't seem like that's going to happen this spring.
How long? I believe what the full rank and file is now allowed to vote on it, correct? That's the way I understand it.
And yes, they've put it to the whole representation now.
How long does that take? I know you're talking about, 1,200 members, I guess, right? But how long is that realistically going to take? Is there a time limit as to when they have to vote? Or
I off the top of my head, I don't know if ownership gave them any kind of hard deadline. It probably wouldn't be the best move for them from a negotiation perspective to do that. But a lot of what's riding on both sides here is the start of the new league year. I think the right. players, certainly the ones like Bud Dupree, who are hitting free agency, would love to have a new CBA set up with a lot more cap space available for teams, because then he's going to cash in even more. And from the owner's perspective, it's more on them, but this filters down to the players as well. The new TV deal that they're going to negotiate with their broadcast partners is going to ensure that there's a ton more cash coming in over the next 10 years. That ensures a large salary cap ceiling, certainly in the short term, but or certainly in the long term, but in the short term, it will impact that as well. So both sides, I think, have motivation to make sure that there isn't a good deal for both parties to be made before the new league year would start March 17th. That to me, I guess, does suggest that maybe there is a hard deadline in place, but after that, there isn't one. So I'm hearing, I mean, Ramon Foster, the Steelers union representative, talks about this a lot. We have another year of the CBA in place. We don't need to make a deal right now. The TV deals aren't going to go anywhere. That's debatable, but I think overall the players do not want to be forced into a deal very much like they were back in 2011, getting a bad deal as it turns out for them, whereas they got a really good deal back in 2006, the last time both sides were kind of pushed to the deadline. I would think both sides would feel better about getting this one done ahead of schedule, getting used to everything that's going on before the new revenue kicks in, but I can see from the players' perspective why the last thing they want to do is rush this and make sure the younger guys who this is really affecting are fully aware of what's going on.
The way I read it, though, Neil, I think the only thing that's an issue is the 17th game. The owners, because they know the 17th game is a gigantic step in a physically demanding game, there are a lot of, quote, like, give backs in here. I mean, it all comes down to playing 17 games, I think.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And to me, the first time I read the proposal the owners were giving them, my first thought was, wow, they would have killed for this back in 2010.
Yes.
I mean, this is an unbelievably better deal than what they got the first time. And you're right. I think the owners gave it to them saying, we're going to give you a little bit more because we want you to sign this right now. We want the TV deals in place. We want all this to be taken care of. We do not want even more negative public relations that we're getting right now. And keep in mind, this is a league that yesterday is talking about bringing back previous official management. You know, the referees people are coming back to fix the problems that they have on that side of the game right now. They've taken enough beatings over the last decade. I really think the owners want this to go away quickly, smoothly, quietly, as best they can. And that, to me, is really where that 48.5% revenue split came from. The owners are giving a lot more than they have in the past. I'm not saying that that's a better deal for the players, but they're giving a lot more. So with that, in my mind, and there have been a couple agents that I've confirmed this with as well, in my mind, it's going to be really hard for the players to get past 17 games. It would behoove the players at this point to put together their best package and use that as part of the acceptance of a 17th game. That's not going anywhere. The owners are not going to take that off the board.
That's right.
Except that that's going to happen. If that's the case, you can cash in, because look at their first position. It's a, you know, you may not think that 2% on a revenue deal like this would be all that big of a bump, but you're talking several hundred million dollars, over a billion in total value
that's
over
right.
the next decade. The younger players would have to love that. You're looking at a massive increase of minimum salary for the younger players, a roster increase, which I don't really even see how that benefits the owners in any way at all. It's clearly done for the players. They're getting a lot from this. I'm not saying that that's the deal they should take, but I think they should take the approach that we're probably going to have to play 17 games at some point, or they're going to lock us out.
And
this is going to be.
The owners feel like they compromised by going from 18 to 17. So I mean,
I would agree with that too.
I mean, I'm telling you what they think. They think they compromised by going to 17.
Right, and I bet they hate their owners among them. They hate the fact that they're giving this much. You're going to cut. They want two games. It makes a lot more sense. It's a home and an away. You know, it makes sense to go two games. Only giving one and cutting preseason games is a loss to them. They're losing something with this deal. Maybe the idea is we'll give a little bit now. The next negotiation, we can see how it goes and maybe go to 18 games then, over a decade of this. But I think all in all, they're getting a lot more in this TV deal than what we're going to be reporting. And as unlike this is typically for the NFL, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they have a plan for the use of streaming technology to increase the value even more. They're able to go back against CBS, NBC, ESPN, and say, we've got Amazon here with the ability to do this. We've got this. It worked great. Twitter did this for us. You know, when Twitter did something of value for us, you better believe we're going to look into that. They're not asking us for a whole lot to broadcast games. So if you want it, you're going to have to pay a little bit more. And we're going to be using these residual services as well. So I think they have much more of an opportunity to make a lot more money than what we might know today. And I think that's why they're willing and able to give a little bit more, and the players should pay attention to that.
See, that's why I looked at the Tony Romo thing. I didn't go into the simplistic, low-hanging fruit of, is he worth $17 million to Brock? Who cares? I mean, he didn't, like, hold all the CBS executives in a room and release them one by one until he got the number. Everybody agreed between CBS and his agents that, okay, that's what we're going to sign for. To me, the significance of it is that CBS is that we want to continue to be a major player when the negotiation comes up, and we got this guy locked up for the full 10 years, and that's what they're trying to do with their network negotiation. It tells you what live sports means to them.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny to me because everybody talks about it as if it's Tony Romo coming back to play quarterback for Washington or something. You know, it's like, he's not a player. This is a broadcast deal. And there's really not much precedent for this, except the last time the NFL got into new broadcasting deals, NBC came in and bought out the rights of Sunday Night Football.
That's right.
And with that, gave them a very fancy package with Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth, who had done a killer job on regional broadcasts up to that point. I always liked Chris Collinsworth on a call.
Yeah, same
They're
putting
here. Them prime time. And also a funny footnote of broadcast history. NBC also bought Pro Football Talk, which you might remember back in for geeky bloggers like myself. Pro Football Talk was an unbelievable revelation of what media could be at that point. It was cutting edge back in 2006, 2007. Yeah. It was growing, and it grew a massive audience for an independent site with no like corporate oversight. It was incredible the reach that site had. Everybody read that back in the day. I'm not sure if they still do or not. The tone of it has changed a lot, but it was a breath of fresh air at a time that you really didn't get news as immediately as somehow or other Florio was able to do. And it set the kind of the standard for a lot of people when it came to blogtainment, if you want to call it that. And NBC was smart enough to see, we want to be a major player with the NFL. So we're going to bring in a big broadcast crew. We're going to launch this entire digital network surrounded by Pro Football Talk, which is this massive website. We'll keep it under control, maybe a little bit better. He won't bash the league as much as he used to, which he hasn't done nearly as much as before he got bought. They put together a gold standard package to say, we want these rights because we want to be in your hip pocket and everything. And NBC is, without question, their flagship broadcast. They get the best games. You can tell. There's usually not a bad matchup on Sunday Night Football. It's usually a bad matchup on Monday Night Football.
Monday
Night Football went by the wayside. You barely even think of it anymore. So I think CBS is trying to do the same thing with Romo. And maybe there's a cost to that back in the day we didn't have. But frankly, even Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth are not Tony Romo. They're not the products of today's digital age. Romo's great. I love listening to him. Games that he calls, I think, are just much more fun. They're much more enjoyable. He has a very unique skill and a very unique gift to do what he's doing. And to have him more than just doing the broadcast, it really doesn't have anything to do with a per-game broadcast. Having him on their side represents way more than what they're paying him. And that his agents know that. The broadcast knows that. I mean, you could put him on golf too while you're there.
Sure, of course you can.
You have rights to him when it comes to golf. I mean, he's his own brand, and he's like no one else we've seen in broadcasting. And well, that's going to come at a price. It still drops in a bucket compared to what they're going to pay to get the rights to the NFL.
That's
right. And having the biggest star only makes sense.
That's exactly right. Like I said, he didn't lock all the CBS executives in a room and then release them one by one to a hostage negotiator. All right.
Thank you so much, Neil. Appreciate it very much, and congrats on the new phone.
Definitely. Thanks for having me, guys.
New Cool on USA Today. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll go from Steelers football to Nittany Lion football. We'll hear from Dwight Gault, the strength and conditioning coach of the Nittany Lions, as we look at how the winter workouts have gone. As we continue here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.